Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello, I'm Miriam Power.
And I'm Michael Stutley. Thanks for joining us in the second podcast in the series dealing with management and mental health.
Michael, we spoke last time about the potential challenges where an employer implements a process to manage performance or conduct or both, and the affected employee then claims that the process has caused a mental health injury.
We did, and we touched on the importance of the timing and the scope of any independent medical examination. Well, we're very fortunate today to have with us Dr. Tom Lee from ReadyMed. Dr. Tom is the Chief Medical Officer at ReadyMed, as well as a consultant occupational physician with particular expertise in undertaking independent medical examinations. Dr. Tom, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself and ReadyMed.
Oh, thanks, Miriam and Michael. Well, firstly, I'm a local graduate here at UWA. I worked around the public hospital systems here and then went into general practice. I did that for about, 10 or 11 years, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I did a lot of family-type medicine, yeah. Also a lot of mental health cases, and there's a lot of workers' compensation as well. And I started sort of develop an interest in workers' comp. I just felt I could do more than what I was doing in GP land, and I just felt, you know, I wasn't sometimes getting the support from key parties, like the employer and the insurer. And often the worker is your long-time patient as a family, and sometimes we train to advocate for them, and sometimes that cannot be the right thing.
It can be a bit difficult. It can be difficult. Because you're just not that as removed.
Exactly, that's right. And you hear only the other side of the story, so, you know, we hear about stress at work and things like that. And we only hear the other side of the story and not so much from the employer side. And sometimes It's good to hear from both sides. Anyway, I joined ReadyMed about 8 years ago. I wasn't looking for anything, for a change. I was really happy where I was. And it's one of those things that just happened, I suppose. And when I started there, I just felt, it was the right place to be. There's a bunch of GPs there and specialists, felt very supported. We have orthopedic surgeons there, neurosurgeons, we have a psychiatrist there. So you can bounce off ideas, you've got, people to talk to get more idea of how to manage people. Right. In GP land, you work autonomously, you get support from fellow GPs, but not so much from the specialists. You can't really just call them
all
the time.
And they're all there together.
They're all there, all
in
house, all within one roof, and we work well as a team, really.
Yeah. And where are you based? Where's ReadyMed based, Dr. Tom?
So ReadyMed, we're based mainly in Perth, so we cover from north and south of the river, from Joondalup, Belmont, Rockingham, Bibra Lake, our four major clinics. And then we've got what we call alliance clinics in the regional areas like Geraldton, Karratha, Port Hedland, where we sort of outsource some of our work, but we make sure that they work to our standards, so to speak, really. So we communicate well with them. We provide some training as well.
And, of course, with the developments of telehealth, you can also assist employers based on the East Coast or with employees based on the East Coast?
Yes, well, we've done telehealth, for many years before it became a norm now, popular now with COVID, I suppose. But yeah, we've been doing it for at least 7 or 8 years. We started with the mining industry because a lot of people are in remote areas. They don't have access to medical support. And the nearest hospital would be 2-3 hours away. So we've done video consults with people, and we can triage how urgent it is from a mental health issue to a physical issue. So it's had a good place. We've developed our own app and all that, but that's a separate issue. But
have to have a look at that.
So it's really been good.
I always like a new app on my phone. So Dr. Tom, perhaps we can set a kind of a theoretical scene for you. Yeah. In the circumstances where an employer may have a long-serving employee, there's been a management process implemented in respect of that employee. It could be for performance, or it could be for conduct, or maybe a bit of both. And then following or during that process, the employee commences a period of personal leave with certification from their doctor saying that they're sick.
And typically what we find, Dr. Tom, is at first the employer is pretty vague about his or her condition. The medical certificates that we see from the treating practitioner simply state that the employee is unfit for work with no other guidance. And the employee often has paid leave entitlements and has complied with all the requisite notification and evidence requirements.
And clearly, if they're a long-serving employee, they will have a lot of paid leave entitlements So, Dr. Tom, do you think that this is an appropriate time to get an external assessment done to determine what is ailing the employee?
Well, yes. Absenteeism in the workplace can be a big problem, whether there is a medical issue or not. Excessive absences from work, you know, causes decreased productivity. Yes, an effect on the company, you know, in the morale, finances, other factors as well. With medical issues, we have to respect the worker's privacy. That's very important. And it's the responsibility of the treating doctor to actually understand the health benefits of work. The longer the person is away from work, the harder it is for them to get back to work. That's been proven time and time again.
It's a really good point.
Yeah, and there's a lot of psychosocial benefits from being at work. And we're there to support them either way, whether they need to be away from work or to actually be at work. And I belong to the Australasian Faculty of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, and there's an initiative called the Health Benefits of Good Work. So our role is really to get people back to work in a safe manner, obviously, and as fast as possible as well. So this initiative is based on compelling evidence that good work is beneficial to people's health and well-being, and that long-term work absence, work disability, and unemployment generally have a negative impact on health and well-being.
So, Dr. Tom, if an examination were to be undertaken at this point, what do you consider would be the appropriate scope of the assessment?
Well, generally when we see a patient, the first thing really, the three principles that we learn in medical school is history, examination, investigation. So really taking a good history, listening to the worker, but I think the history also, what we call collateral history, from the employer to understand before we see them, if we can get that background information about what's happening at work, do you yourself as the employer think there's some stress at work or bullying or anything at all, if it comes to that issue. Then we certainly need to concentrate on that and obviously examine them. Examination can be both physical and mental health as well. So we are trained to examine someone through the interview process on things like the demeanor, their body language, how they speak, how they're thinking, all that sort of things gives us a bit of an idea of their mental thought process.
And would you then necessarily do that investigation yourself, or would you refer on to one of your colleagues? So from the employer's perspective, they don't know what is wrong with this employee. They've just got a certificate saying they're unfit. They've been sent off for an independent medical assessment by your group, and they see somebody general, presumably, because nobody knows what's wrong with them. What happens if it becomes clear that at some point they might need the assessment of a specialist?
Yeah, sure. So we will do as much as we can in the background. If someone's had recent tests, then, you know, we don't want to waste resources by repeating them. So we can find out what's happened, what they've done. Then we would ask maybe to get some information from their family GP, if they had blood tests, x-rays, MRIs, anything that we think is relevant and appropriate. So if we don't think it's relevant, then we don't want to pry too much into, you know, too many privacy issues. That will certainly help us, you know, to set the background scene about what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And give us an idea. And the key, I suppose, really is making a diagnosis, a medical diagnosis. That's always very important. Stress is a symptom, it's not a diagnosis as such.
Right.
So we say, well, you're stressed, but why are you stressed? Have you got a medical issue? So this is where we have to separate from just emotional thoughts and ideas than
actual clinical diagnosis.
And then we can decide what treatment to do, because we would not act as a HR or a PR person. We're there to treat from a medical point of view, inform the person what we think should be done, and help facilitate that when they go back to your regular GP. And I suppose with their consent, inform the employer about what needs to be done from the medical side of things. And once we treat that as best we can, and we see how that affects their work and how we can help them go back into work.
And you've really hit an important point there, Dr. Tom, where you've said that we, as in doctors, don't act as HR or as the employer, and that is the importance of an independent medical examination, isn't it? That you are the physician and you have a particular expertise, and you are using that expertise to assist an employer to understand what is the problem, what's the diagnosis, what's the ailment, and then it's ultimately the employer takes it from there.
That's correct. I think family GPs, you know, I was a GP before, and we were trained really to advocate for the patient. That means everything they say, in a way, is right. But as an independent doctor, we are trained to not take sides, not take the referral side, whether it's the insurer or the legal, or sorry, the employer or the lawyer or the worker side. So we have to really gather as much information as we can, make an independent decision for the best of, I suppose, in a way, the person. So, yeah, that's really important.
So, Michael, I've actually come across some circumstances where an employee has been directed to attend an independent medical examination and they've refused. They say they're too sick to attend an independent medical examination. What happens in those circumstances?
Well, it's actually not an uncommon circumstance where employees do say that they're too sick to attend an independent medical examination, but there is plenty of authority to the effect that employees can be lawfully directed to attend such examinations, and in fact, the failure to do so can be a valid reason for dismissal. It can amount to breach of contract, breach of policy, and such things. Dr. Tom, can you envisage any circumstance where an employee could validly claim that they are unwell, or well enough, I should say, to go and be examined by their own practitioner, but not to be examined by an independent medical practitioner?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I've seen people in wheelchairs and with, you know, serious physical ailments and any other circumstances as well. So there's no real reason why they come in. Often that's a red flag, really. There may be some underlying information that they don't want to inform the employer or us. And when they do come to see us, you know, one of the things I do really is to make them comfortable, try to develop rapport, not trying to fool them or anything like that, but try to set the scene to say, look, I'm here to help you. I'm not here to take sides. I'm not here to punish you or anything like that.
Yes.
And you know, whether they trust or believe us or not, that's a different story, obviously. But no, there's no real reason. And now even more with telehealth, you know, I've done it again with people from remote areas when there were restrictions to flying, for example. I've done it with telehealth. People up in Darwin and Karratha with telehealth.
Yes.
You can do independent medical
examinations. So there's no logistical reason for a refusal.
Absolutely no.
And when you say a red flag about, you know, not wanting to disclose, how does that work in terms of privacy? Do you need to have the employee's consent to share private information about their condition with the employer?
The short answer to that is yes, always, really. Privacy, there's a Privacy Act which we all have to adhere to, really. It can be tricky, but it doesn't stop us from doing the assessment. So it really depends on the skill of the doctor. I'm not saying I'm skillful, but
I'm sure you are, Dr. Tom.
But so what I've done in that situation is I'll say, look, we'll talk. And at the end of the assessment, if you still don't give me permission to write a report, I can't. Because if I write something against your consent, you have a right to sue me in court and report me to my medical board. So I still have to adhere to my ethics, medical ethics of privacy and confidentiality. Usually that calms them down, and I've actually never had anyone not giving me consent at the end of that, and I'll say, look, this is what I'm going to say, this is what I'm not going to say. Some things I would agree it's private, for example, your sexuality, or you've got, you know, HIV and you don't want someone to know.
Yes.
I said, they don't need to know that, but it doesn't stop me from making a medical conclusion on your fitness to work. I'll give an example. I had a guy who had type 1 diabetes.
Right.
And he's been discriminated before in his previous employer. And his current employer wanted to change him from working day shift that he's done for a long time to doing shift work, so day and nights.
Mm-hmm.
He's got enough medical evidence to say that if he did shift work, it would affect his medical condition.
Right.
Because of the timing of meals and taking the medication with insulin. That's
yeah.
Right. And he's got that from his specialist as well. He didn't want his employer to know he's got type 1 diabetes, full
right.
stop. And I said, look, that's fine. I said, let me assess your diabetes, what your control is, and why you can't work shift work. And I did my report such that I've got a medical diagnosis. I've got enough information, which he hasn't given me consent to tell you about. But he's, I've, you know, suffice to say, I've got enough information to say that he's actually not fit to do shift work,
right.
but he's fit enough to do normal day work and not changing shifts. without giving them a reason. And hopefully that's enough to satisfy them, but at least they've had an independent assessment without knowing the diagnosis. Because if they just got it from the GP or from the treating specialist, they wouldn't know what to do in that situation, and they would give all the information.
And that's a fair compromise, I think, particularly where the employer does need that independent assessment undertaken, and consent may not be given, but you are able to give an indication of fitness for work, yes or no. And I think one of the things that does come out from that is the importance of the scope of the request in the first place, the referral from the employer to the doctor, because often you'll see, I'm sure, long lists of questions that come from employers, and in really getting that part of the independent medical referral right is critical, right down to even this point that you've just made about consent.
Yeah, no, that's correct. So, yeah, look, asking us the right questions, and we'll try to answer them as best as we can. But if the person doesn't give us consent, then, you know, we can still complete the assessment enough to at least help them get back to work and to remain at work. That's important. Because safety at work is the other thing. So not just fitness to work. You may consider fit, but you may not be considered safe. So that's one of the other things that we assess for as well. Yeah.
So, Michael, in your experience, in circumstances where employees have refused to give the consent for the independent medical examiner to disclose results to the employer, what is the employer's right of response in relation to that?
Well, it's generally a contractual or a policy term that employees will give the requisite consents for the external examiner to share the results and the assessment with the employer. And generally, good contracts will have that built into them. There will also be policies that support it. It is good practice when you are directing an employee to be attending an independent medical examination that you outline to that employee where that consent arises, and it's usually a matter of the contract of employment, and you explain to them the importance of giving that consent. And if an employee fails to provide the consent in that context, not unlike a failure to attend the examination in the first place, it could be a disciplinary matter.
Right, okay. So let's say we're now, Dr. Tom, if I take you back to our hypothetical situation, let's say that after an examination, it's actually determined that an employee suffers from some kind of mental health issue. Is the treating physician able to establish from that examination what the cause of that mental health issue is?
Look, generally, mental health issues and diagnosis should be left to psychiatrists. Right. They've got this, what we call a DSM criteria. It's a medical criteria, and other people try to adopt it, but without the experience of actually, you know, it's not a cookbook where you go, oh, you fit into all these categories, you've got this medical condition. So I leave that to the psychiatrist, and they can tell whether someone actually has what we call a clinical diagnosis, as opposed to you feel a bit down and depressed or sad because you're stressed at work. So stress is a different thing as well. I mean, it depends on three core factors. Firstly, it's the job itself. So, you know, whether there's a conflict at work, you know, between the person's capability and the demands, you know, their job satisfaction, they didn't get the promotion they wanted. You know, then obviously there's always the alleged bullying, you know, lack of support. That's the first thing. The second thing is their personality. So some people, you know, they crumble under the pressure of the work, which is considered, I suppose, what is expected of you. I don't use the word normal, but it's what's expected of you to do the job. And if you can't do the job and you're stressed, you know, that doesn't always lead to a mental health diagnosis, really. And the third thing, really, you know, is there anything happening in the background? Their social circumstances, have they got good support? You know, have they got family members? Have they got marital issues? Any other thing, really.
Because it's true, isn't it, Dr. Tom, that something could be going on in their personal life which makes them perhaps less robust in the workplace to deal with the normal slings and arrows, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So a psychiatrist goes through all that. So again, we train to take a good history. In a history, you go, your presenting complaint, what are symptoms you're feeling now, you know, your family history of, say, mental health issues, your background, you know, were you bullied as a child, you know, what was your upbringing like, how did your parents treat you, substance abuse, you know, everything really, then they can make a diagnosis about what sort of personality they have and then whether they are so susceptible to mental health issues. And then at that point in time, they can make a diagnosis whether they actually have a mental health condition or not. Not always with the first, sometimes not with just a one interview. Sometimes it may take more than one interview just to get to know them a little bit better, and then getting a little bit collateral history from the employer as well. So it's interesting, and it is difficult. It should be left to the specialist. At ReadyMed, we leave that to our panel of psychiatrists. We've got three on our panel at the moment. It's not for, say, even an occupational physician.
Right. So what if a patient clearly stresses to you that their condition has been caused or triggered by the employer's actions, Dr. Tom?
Look, according to the Work Cover W statistics, you know, stress claims in WA are predominantly due to work pressure. It could be some violence at work, you know, and traumatic events and bullying as well. So you want to find out really as much as you can about, you know, what's triggered off the stress, and from there you can, you know, try to help them as much really as best as possible. But I think early intervention is really important. Trying to find out, you know, what's happening in the background before it escalates and they decide to you know, lodge a workers' compensation claim. So the earlier you can identify work-related stress, the sooner steps can be taken to prevent it from escalating into becoming a potential mental health condition, or if they have something even pre-existing, again, we don't discriminate. There are a lot of people who are well and stable, they're on treatment. As long as they're on treatment, then you know, they can remain at work. And if their condition has deteriorated because of either non-work-related or work-related issues, you know, that's what we have to tease out and try to help and support them as much as possible.
And that kind of dials back to the importance of having this type of assessment done early on in the piece. Your employee is saying that they're unfit for work after an internal process. They haven't turned up. You don't know what's wrong. You send them off for an independent medical examination, and now the employer becomes aware that there's a workplace issue. So if there's going to be early intervention in the workplace, at least, this is the time to do it. So if that's the case, so let's assume based on an external medical assessment, an employee is found to be experiencing a mental health condition and that circumstances at work are at least partially causative. What, if any, obligations, Michael, do you think there are on the employer at this point to investigate, for example, if there's a claim by the employee that there has been bullying, harassment or discrimination?
Well, that's a good question, Miriam. If the employee has not lodged a grievance with the employer and the first the employer comes to know about the employee's complaint is from comments made during a medical assessment, what could or should the employer do?
Well, yes, and that does drive home the advantages of getting the employee into an external assessment relatively early, because it flushes out the issues at a stage where there is actually some prospect of dealing with them. If the employer doesn't understand the issues for a protracted period of time, the likelihood of being able to properly address them becomes less and less. So, Dr. Tom, would you be able to take us through the process of an independent medical examination and the sort of information you expect to get from the referring employer?
Well, look, the information from the employer really is as much as possible what's happening in the workplace, and what you think you know is the issue and what steps you've taken and what's working and what's not working. And then I suppose asking us, you know, is there a medical condition or not? And I touched this before that, you know, we have to be quite clear that there is actually a medical condition and a medical diagnosis. So, you know, we take into account again the history, family history, childhood history, and other things. And also other medical conditions, you know, so someone's had a recent diagnosis of, you know, heart problem or evidence that people who say suffer a minor heart attack actually go on to lead to depression. So you may not know the person's had a heart attack, he's had a life-changing experience, and he feels a little bit depressed and he needs some counseling and some time off work. He doesn't want you to know about it. So we take all that into account, the physical side, the mental side as well. And if a person does not have a medical condition, so we're talking about, you know, really just stress at work, then we try to understand the workplace factors. But without really, again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, being the HR or PR and trying to solve the workplace issues, try to understand from them, and we can, I suppose, feedback the information they've given us to yourself, and then let you handle that.
So what kind of things do you find annoying, from a referrer's point of view? So where employers or lawyers send you a letter and ask you to undertake an independent medical examination, is there anything that you commonly see which you think, oh, gee, you know, this comes up all the time, I wish it didn't, it complicates things, it makes it harder?
Well, sometimes lack of information, that certainly doesn't help. And then sometimes we get too many questions. We've seen some referral letters with 40 questions, and we go, are you sure you want me, you know, this is going to take me a lot of time to try to answer each, and they just same similar questions being repeated, really. So I think sometimes for us, when we get a referral letter, it helps to pick up the phone and ask, what are you trying to achieve out of this assessment before we even, the patient comes.
And that's the key question, isn't it? What do you want out of this assessment? What are you trying to achieve? Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. I think, again...
And you could normally answer that on one hand, couldn't you? Yeah. Like, what is wrong with this person?
Yeah.
You know, what treatment will they require?
Yeah.
And if they will come back to work? And if so, in what capacity?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
right.
Generally it, isn't it?
Yeah. The other thing that we train at, as occupational physicians and independent medical examiners, is causation. So, you know, just because one thing leads to another doesn't mean that has caused it. And again, through our training experience, what you think has happened, is that what we consider, is it a significant cause, you know, by definition, in causing whatever the problems or symptoms are.
Right. So can you perhaps just touch on that concept of significance a little bit more? Because what I'm getting from that, Dr. Tom, is that a patient might self-report, for example, that the way they feel is caused by something that's happened in the workplace. So how do you tease out from a self-report in that nature as to A, whether they've got a condition, if it's a clinical condition, and B, whether the causation that the patient self-reports is in fact, you know, objectively, significantly causative?
I think, so part of the history taking is actually the occupational history. So asking really what they do at work. So the nature and duration of the employment, how long they've been there, the tasks that they do at work. Again, we're assuming we're not talking about all just office workers, we're talking about, you know, manual workers as well. And then whether there's anything pre-existing. So, could this have occurred outside of work anyway? What's the likelihood of it occurring? So if someone say got some degenerative condition, was it the likelihood of it happening outside of work, for example, right, you know, at home as well? Any genetic factors, anything else in the individual's health generally? So for example, again, I touch, you know, so chronic conditions like diabetes and heart disease can lead to mental health issues as well.
Right.
So, you know, we take all that into account and again, we try to provide a holistic picture really in coming up to a diagnosis and not just listening to what they have to say, but really trying to tease out as much information by asking the right questions as well. So history taking itself, it can be an art,
right,
from a medical point of view.
And so an employer, what will our experience is we'll generally, if there's been an independent medical examination where the employee has for the first time raised a concern about issues in the workplace, whether it's bullying, discrimination, harassment or whatever. And so the question then becomes for the employer, well, now that we're aware of this because that's been raised with the independent medical examiner, what do we do internally? Bearing in mind that the hypothetical scenario that we've put to you, Dr. Tom, is where a person is only is kind of in this situation because an internal management process was implemented, it seems to have triggered some kind of mental health response from this individual. They've now reported that in the context of an independent medical examination. And so the employer, being a good citizen and being a responsible employer, considers it's appropriate in all the circumstances to conduct an internal inquiry. But of course, the question remains, if that person was unable to participate in the management process that has led to them having a mental health concern, can they participate in a process to investigate their concerns?
The main thing really, again, what is the condition we're talking about, and then what treatment is required? So that's quite important. So I think we have to be quite clear about what treatment we recommend, if they need any treatment or not. Because if it's just a question of stress and they need counselling or they need to sort out their personal life, then that's not a medical treatment as such.
But would you ever assess somebody as not being fit to participate in a workplace investigation?
If they have a medical condition, yes. Right. So if someone has a severe, say, depression, for example, and they have thoughts of self-harm, which is, again, duty of care is always the person's health, then we say, look, you know, does this person need to be admitted to a hospital, and what medications they need, how intense the treatment is. So duty of care, again, is their health. And we may say that at that point in time, we can say, look, temporarily, it may be detrimental to their health if they were to participate in further investigations. But barring that, the answer is, probably everything's just temporarily, really. With the appropriate treatment, then we can also give you an indication of what the outcome is going to be, how long it may take. So it gives you a bit of an idea. Say, look, this is serious. It may take a few months or a few weeks, I'm not sure. And then sometimes you need that second assessment after they've had the treatment. So I think the initial part is just to get that as much information as you can, leading them to the right treatment pathway. And then if they need the treatment, get the appropriate treatment, get them as well as we can, then we move on to that next step.
And those are all the really important points which come through ultimately in your final report, which then goes back to the employer. And Miriam, I guess one of the topics that will come up in our next podcast actually is going to be, well, now that we receive a report from someone like you, Dr. Tom, what do we do with it? What does an employer do with it? And there are plenty of things that come up and there are complications that arise. But Dr. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today and providing us with some fascinating insights into the work that you do, into independent medical examinations. And Miriam, I look forward to discussing with you in our next podcast, what do we do with Dr. Tom's report?
Thank you, Dr. Tom.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you very much.